Consider for just a moment just how convenient. Today we can slip into a grocery store in the dead of winter and slip out with a package of peas that taste as fresh as summer. Good food has not always been this convenient, and so today we pause to look back and ask, how did food become so convenient?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 777th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends along the shores of Manila Bay who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Folks, imagine for just a moment that we are, you and I are in the tiny Alaskan fishing village of Elfin Cove, and in being the dead of winter, and we hunger for something green, something fresh, something that will remind us of summer. No problem. We simply slip into the village grocery store and slip out with a package of fresh frozen peas that taste nearly as fresh as the day they were harvested months ago and thousands of miles away. And here's the best part. We take those peas for granted, as if they had always been there for us to enjoy in the dead of winter. But the truth is, good food has not always been so convenient, and today we pause to ask, how did food become so convenient? Here to help us answer that question, we have an old friend, Mark Kurlansky, author of Bird's Eye, The Adventures of a Curious Mind. Mark, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Nice to be here, Michael.
You know, last we talked, it was some time ago, we talked about food of a younger land, but we've also talked about cod, and we talked about oysters, and we talk about all kinds of things. Why do we look back, as you have done so often in your writings, to the way things were?
Well, I mean, it's... that's the question of why do we look at history at all? Because, you know, because of that great question, how did I get here?
Amen. Does it help us appreciate, you know, I mean, we take our food so for granted, it's almost ridiculous to be able to walk into a grocery store in the frozen wastes of the far north and there's a package of fresh frozen peas that taste almost as if they were, had just been picked.
Yeah, or, you know, an experience more common to most people is to, you know, just get food completely out of season or from, you know, a complete other place, or, you know, to no longer be limited by geography or climate.
And that really has become the story of the modern city, has it not? Because cities no longer produce.
As a matter of fact, in the late 19th century, when cities started to grow much larger, like particularly New York, one of the reasons for that was the development of refrigeration and ice boxes, because, you know, you can't have large populations of people in a place that produces no food unless you have some sort of a way of preserving food and making it available.
And thus the ice box. Now,
right.
Now, New York City was once 100 million tons of ice every year?
Yeah, New York City was, you know, the most iced place in the world. It was cut in frozen lakes in New England and upstate New York and kept in ice houses that were insulated by sawdust along the lower Hudson, and it was a way of life in New York, and, you know, one of those things that made New Yorkers always feel a little lost when they left New York, you know, no ice.
There's no ice. And thus a huge industry, and people, of course, would buy their ice from the ice house and store it in their ice box.
It's kind of curious. There were certain other places that were big ice places also. New Orleans, kind of counterintuitive, you know, kind of a warm place. But New Orleans imported a huge amount of ice, which is why New Orleans became a famous cocktail place.
Well, really? Just because they had the ice, what did they do, float it down the Mississippi?
Yeah, they shipped it in. And, you know, there are accounts when they first started doing this of, you know, people, the workers, stevedores, and the people who moved the ice out didn't understand how to handle it. You know, it's 90 degrees.
What is this
walking
stuff?
Walking around with the stuff, right?
And it would melt on them, yeah. Well, you tell the story of the... I guess the industrial, I hate to use that word, but I guess that's what we're talking about here, is the industrialization of food.
Absolutely. And you know, here's the important thing about the context of history. You hate to use that word because we have a negative concept of industrialization. But, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, industrialization was like... you know, cyberspace. It was this new thing that made all kinds of exciting things possible.
And thus, and that to me is really the interesting point of this conversation that we're going to have today about the making of food convenient for us all to use, is because I think, you know, we kind of forgot about how convenient our food is, and we take it for granted, and thus we kind of are dismissive of the whole notion of industrialized food, and yet it really has changed our world and make it really possible for us to move off the farm and into the city.
Yeah, and it made a lot of things possible, but you know, you have to understand that this was at a time when industry, in a lot of ways, was, you know, transportation, because there were now cars and electricity and electric light bulbs, and you know, people in our time talk a lot about how the world is changing, but the world has always changed, and industrialization led to huge changes, and just like today, it put a lot of people out of work and put a lot of different people in work and destroyed old industries and or old economic activities and created new ones and reconfigured the world.
Well, Mark Kolanski, you tell this story through the eyes, as it were, of Clarence Birdseye, who I'm sure everybody knows by virtue of Birdseye Frozen Foods, but probably people haven't really thought about the fact that there was actually a person named Clarence Birdseye. How did you come to meet Clarence Birdseye?
Yeah, a lot of people don't seem, they know that name because of frozen food and don't realize that it was actually a person. I guess I first came across him when I was doing my cod book, because he tremendously changed the fish industry. And he did it in Gloucester, Massachusetts, which was a one of the great cod ports, and is still
kind of like the Silicon Valley of cod.
Yes, I have to think if that's possible. But
well, in that he brought this technical innovation to the cod industry. Kind of, you know, we could almost get away with the analogy, but...
Right. He also appears in my salt book because, you know, he had a lot to do with destroying the salt business because, you know, until Clarence Birdseye came along with fast frozen food, the leading way of preserving food, especially fish, was by salting.
Mm-hmm. And you could still find salted cod in markets, can't you?
Yes, because... you know, of a few strange people like me who just really like it. It's never been as popular in the U.S. as in other countries that have a tradition of salt food. But, you know, we eat a lot of salted foods that, you know, were salted for preservation, and we don't need to do that anymore. But, you know, we still eat ham and bacon and... anchovies and many salted foods.
Well, And then this Clarence Birdseye was a particularly interesting fellow because he was just probably the opposite of what you'd expect in today's real man, right?
Well, he was a person who didn't look at all like who he was. I mean, he was 5'7" and balding and wore these thick spectacles.
And he was a hunter.
He was a, I don't know if I want to say voracious or ferocious, but he killed a lot of animals.
He killed a lot of animals, which, of course, is the story we're going to pick up. We're going to meet Clarence Birdseye, and we're going to talk about the industrialization of our food, making it convenient so that what we used to eat, salted foods, preserved foods, then became fresh frozen foods. So now we can enjoy the best of our summer harvest in the dead of winter or thousands of miles away. With us today, Mark Kurlansky, author of Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man, and you. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, it's so easy to eat these days because food is so convenient. But it wasn't always that way. It wasn't always possible to eat fresh peas in the middle of winter in faraway Alaska or anywhere else, for that matter. It used to be a lot different. With us today to talk about that, Mark Kurlansky, author of Birdseye, the author of The Adventures of a Curious Man. And Birdseye, Clarence Birdseye, was a curious man. And looking back in history, at his history, is a way of really looking at the industrialization of our food talking about where we came from where we're going. And where he went was to the wild, wild west, and what he discovered was a lot of canned food. Mark?
Yeah, he got a job with the U.S. Biological Survey, which is a federal agency under agriculture. And they were supposed to kind of monitor what wildlife existed in America, but in reality, what they did is they took note of what wildlife annoyed farmers and ranchers and tried to kill it all. And that was his job. In what was then the Arizona and New Mexico territories, he would wander around and they'd say, go get a certain species, and he'd get it. Killed a lot of coyotes and wildcats, which is, you know, how they became endangered. You know, the irony is that the U.S. Biological Survey later changed its name to U.S. Fish and Wildlife and became charged with bringing back the endangered species
that they got rid of in the first place. Yeah,
right.
And in those adventures, though, Clarence Birdseye learned a little bit about canned food because canned food really was the food of the West.
He was a true food lover. I mean, he looked at anything and wondered what it would taste like and, you know, killed it and ate it. Later, he became more sophisticated. He killed it and froze it and then ate it.
And then ate it, too.
Most people weren't like him, and they weren't eating gophers and all these things they ran across. They were eating canned food. And he talked about how out in the Arizona Territory, you knew you were getting near a population center because you'd find all these piles of cans around.
And having been raised in Montana and as a Boy Scout, endured a lot of campouts, I can attest to the fact that it's not, canned foods is still part of the scene up there, or at least it was when I was a kid. And
yeah, it's interesting that he, among his wide taste in food all his life, he did eat a lot of canned food because it was nostalgic to him. It reminded him of when he was young out hunting in the West.
And from the Wild West, Clarence ended up in Labrador farming foxes, of all things, right?
Yeah, he went there with a medical missionary, was looking for somebody in a hospital ship, and Labrador just froze over for 8 months a year and nothing could get in, and instead of leaving with the ship, he stayed on because, you know, this was his curiosity. You know, he was, while he was going around on this medical missionary, he ran into fox fur people and he'd asked them a lot of questions and he got interested in doing this and he stayed on as a fur trader
and then
a fox breeder
and became a fox entrepreneur and was even down in New York City raising funds for his fox enterprise up in Labrador.
But this is what is sort of extraordinary to me. I mean, here's this guy born in Brooklyn.
5'7".
Right, he's had some adventures out west, but he's now in this frozen place where the only means of transportation is dog sleds, and he learns how to do that, how to, you know, control herds of teams of dogs and travel hundreds of miles by dog sled. He learns how to breed and raise wild foxes, which, you know, takes some know-how. And he breaks into this fur business that he knew nothing about.
And was making some serious money raising fox furs.
Right.
But it was in the frozen wastes of the far north that he really discovered frozen foods, right?
Yeah, what happened was he got married, and he married a woman who was the daughter of one of the founders of the National Geographic Society. So she was very used to crazy men who went off to wild places. Her father was one of them. Her uncle was one of them. And so she married him, and they had a baby, and, you know, he said, well, dear, you know, I live in Labrador. And she said, well, fine. And she went up and brought the infant, and they're living 200 miles by dog sled from the nearest medical facility. And then he started worrying about the Labrador diet, which he had kind of enjoyed, you know, over the years he had been there, you know, eating all these exotic things. But there wasn't a lot of fresh food in the winter and no fresh greens. And when he had been working with the medical missionary, I mean, they would go around telling people that the reason they had beriberi and all these diseases was that they weren't getting enough fresh food and enough greens. So this concerned him about his wife and son. Meanwhile, you know, when you started the show and you were talking about the frozen peas in northern Alaska, I was listening to that and I was thinking, you know, there's a hidden contradiction there. You can have frozen anything in northern places.
You certainly can, which is what he discovered, right?
Yeah, well, he watched the Inuit's fish, you know, and the fish would freeze the second they were taken out of the water because, you know, it was 40 degrees below zero. And he would watch them do this. And he claimed that sometimes when they thawed out the fish, they would be alive, which was something he tried to reproduce for years and years and never succeeded in doing. But, you know, he lived in a world in which frozen food was awful. It was frozen at about 30 degrees above zero, just below freezing, very slowly. And when you thawed it out, it was just mushy and terrible. And
that had been going on for like 50 years, right?
Yeah, since the Civil War. And we're now talking about 1915.
So we're talking about ice house freezing almost then, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be freezing that takes a long time. at very relatively high temperatures.
Yeah, a few days. And, you know, meat, they would freeze a whole side of beef, and that, you know, it would basically be rotten, you know.
Right.
This frozen fish, you know, he said it tasted just like fresh. And always in his whole frozen food career, that's what he said about frozen food, is that it tastes just like fresh. Now, you know, which was the origin of the phrase, it was a Bird's Eye Company phrase, fresh frozen, which is a, you know, a built-in contradiction. We don't really think that fresh food and frozen food taste the same. But what you have to understand is he was comparing it to canned food, salted food, or slow frozen food. And compared to those, it was just like fresh. He would, in the summertime, get greens, get cabbage and different things, and bring it up to their place in Labrador. And they called it ice packing. They were snow packing. They would just put it in barrels with snow and leave it outdoors. And when you wanted some, you would take a hatchet and chop some off and thaw it out. And they lived on this frozen food. And then he came back to the States when World War I broke out, which had huge implications for the fur business because Europe was the big fur market.
Right.
And so he came back to the States, and then he didn't think about frozen food at all anymore. Nobody wanted it. Nobody liked it. There was no real need for it. And, you know, he could get fresh food in New York and Washington, which were the two places he lived.
And then something happened. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to find out what the big trick was that flipped Clarence Birdseye into the king of fresh frozen food, thus making food convenient for you and I. Right back with Mark Gerlansky. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about how convenient it is to eat food. Oh my goodness, just swing into the nearest convenience store, run in, grab a package of whatever, throw it in the microwave, it's done, you're eating, you're on your way again. But it wasn't always that way. It was much more complicated in the past, and we're talking about how we managed to industrialize our food, make it more convenient for us, with Mark Kurlansky, author of Bird's Eye, The Adventure of a Curious Man. And he was a curious man. Up there in the frozen wastes of Labrador, he learned all about freezing foods. He learned there was a difference between fresh frozen or flash frozen or freezing really quickly, and then the slow freezing that they practiced at the time. Mark, what was the difference? So you talk about the big crystals and the small crystals.
Yeah, you know, this is something that salt makers had known for centuries, that crystals that are formed slowly are larger than crystals that are formed quickly. This is why solar evaporated sea salt is coarse.
Mm-hmm.
And when you form crystals slowly, distort and destroy tissue structure in the things that are freezing. And
so it kind of breaks down the tissue structure of whatever frozen thing you're freezing, whatever food you're freezing.
So the faster you can freeze something, the less damage you do to it.
Mm-hmm. And
so
thus,
if you can freeze something in a matter of a second or two, as the Inuits did when they hauled a fish into 40 degree below zero air, it's going to be in pretty good shape.
And thus, Clarence Birdseye's discovery that, hey, this stuff really tastes good, and much better than the stuff that's frozen really slowly. What really flipped his switch and turned him on to the notion of an possibilities of an industry?
Well, this was maybe 5-6 years after he was back from Labrador. Hadn't done anything with frozen food, hadn't thought about it. And he had a job with an organization called the U.S. Fisheries Association, which was kind of a lobbying group for fisheries, and they worked on fishery problems, all kinds of things like creating a code so that you could telegraph your order in fewer words and save money, and transporting a fish, and lots of different things. And Birdseye loved problem solving, and he was working on the problem of how do you get a fresh fish to the market in a condition similar to what it was in when it was first hauled out of the water. And he tried all kinds of things with new packaging and different ways of doing things, and nothing really worked. And suddenly, he remembered Labrador. And he always said that he had this theory that ideas get stored in your head, and then when you need them, they'll just pop out. I'm not sure this is true, but in this particular case, that's what happened. And he started remembering all the stuff he had done just for his family in Labrador with freezing food, and he decided that, you know, this was the solution to the problem. And he also decided that he wanted to do more than just sell frozen food. He started a business in New York freezing fish, and it went under because nobody wanted frozen food. There was no market for it.
Because it had such a bad reputation. Everybody knew how bad frozen food was because it was bad.
The state of New York banned serving frozen food to prisoners.
That was bad.
Right. And he started thinking that what he should do is create a whole new industry just from the ground up. And so he started this company in Gloucester that froze food. But basically, the people that he took on as his partners, he took on two kinds of people. He took on financial people, and he took on engineers. And what they were doing was developing processes for frozen food with the idea that they would sell the patents to somebody who had big-time money and would create this industry. And that's what they did. They actually didn't sell a lot of their frozen food, but they developed all kinds of not only machinery for freezing food, but ways of packaging it. They got the DuPont company to develop cellophane wrappers, all kinds of ways so that you could produce frozen food in family-sized packages.
And thus a industry was not only about freezing, it was about packaging. You know,
a lot of it was about packaging. If you look at his patents, which, by the way, there were over 300 of, he went into other fields also, but many of his patents are for packaging. But, you know, at the time he was doing this, there really wasn't, it wasn't commercially viable. Not only was there no market for it, but there was no way to transport it. Stores didn't have any freezers. People didn't have freezers in their homes.
So there were a lot of problems to solve.
Right. I mean, it was creating really an entirely new industry.
Now, you make a lot of a real interesting distinction between the European way of tackling the world and the Yankee way of tackling the world.
Yeah. You know, there's always exceptions to every rule, but by and large, American inventors were never very interested in theoretical science. The whole American concept of inventing was to come up with something that had a practical application, build a company, and produce it. This is what Alexander Graham Bell did and what Thomas Edison did, what Robert Fulton did. You know, people remember Robert Fulton as the inventor of the steamboat. He didn't invent the steamboat at all. He didn't invent anything. He just set up the first commercial steamship line that made money. And this was very much the American idea.
And that's what Clarence Birdseye was looking at, too.
Right. Einstein, interestingly, a German who then became an American, and he used to complain about this, about how Americans just had no patience for theoretical science. Of course, he was a purely theoretical scientist and abhorred the actual things that were made from his theoretical science, like nuclear bombs and stuff. He was just completely involved in theory. American inventors were, by and large, not like this at all. And Birdseye certainly wasn't. Birdseye, very early in his life, started talking about how he wasn't really interested in theoretical science. He wanted to develop a commercial idea.
Well, let's come back. Let's talk about how Clarence Birdseye learned how to flash freeze frozen foods and then create an industry around those foods. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Mark Kurlansky, author of Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man and You. You'd like to participate today, feel free to do so. 831-479 is the phone number, 831-479-1080. And we are talking about the industrialization of food and how we make food convenient for you and I to eat. Right back. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. You know, Sir Francis Bacon, the famous European philosopher, died, quite literally, trying to figure out the secret of frozen food. And yet, Clarence Birdseye, the 5'7" Yankee from Gloucester, figured it out and thus made changed the way we eat food and made possible, essentially, the huge concentrations of people we pack into cities. How did he do it? What was the secret to this flash frozen food that really changed the nature of the frozen food industry? Mark Kurlansky knows because he wrote the book. Mark, how did he do it?
Well, first of all, we got to set the record straight on something, because there's millions of people from Brooklyn, and we don't want to get them mad at us. He was from Brooklyn.
From Brooklyn, yes.
He later moved to Gloucester to do his work.
Okay, fair enough. What is it about Brooklyn? It's like that there. Those Brooklyn people were pretty darn tenacious in building a country.
Well, you know, when he was growing up in Brooklyn, it was not part of New York City. It was a separate city, and it was the third largest city in the United States. And I think that the process by which they became incorporated into New York City always, you know, created this identity crisis that they always have to get on.
Amen. So how did this little Brooklyn guy, this 5'7", bespectacled, gentle man who was a rabid hunter of wild animals, how did he go about figuring out how to flash freeze foods so that it did not taste mushy and disgusting as the frozen food of its day did? What was the secret?
Well, his starting point was the Labrador winter. What was it about the Labrador winter that made this frozen food so good? And the very apparent answer was that it was really, really cold and things froze very quickly. So you had to develop a machine that would go down to very low temperatures and freeze things very quickly. A freezing process that was speeded up by creating machines that sort of press the food together. This original freezing equipment was called a belt freezer, and it was two belts that were treated with a salt that, you know, salts are very odd things. Salt raises the it raises the boiling point and lowers the freezing point of things, so it can be used to melt ice. But it also lowers the temperature of things, and is basically the still today the primary way in which artificial freezing is done.
Hmm.
So food, he would pack food in boxes of a size suitable to a family, and run them through these two belts, so it was kind of pressed between these two belts that were frozen. Later, a later machine which is basically the prototype for freezing machines today, was rather than a belt, it was a series of plates. And then they were hollow plates that were filled with a solution to make it frozen. And the hollow plate freezer is still the basic prototype of how commercially frozen food is done today.
And so he was able to freeze food quickly and package it and thus create a whole new product. And
right.
Yet
it came out packaged, which was a, you know, in itself an innovation because, you know, they used to just freeze things in huge blocks, which was pretty useless unless you were, you know, feeding an army, which actually was originally what they were doing.
And thus he had his family-friendly product. But people weren't too excited about this stuff. There was no infrastructure to sell it. There was no way of getting it to market. How do you go about building that entire industry?
Well, the first thing he did is he achieved his goal of selling it. And he sold it to the Post Company, which was a company that had come out of C.W. Post, who invented cereal and an artificial coffee and a few other food products.
Postum,
exactly.
Yep.
Made millions on it. And the thing that really distinguished the Post Company is that he was a kind of a marketing genius. His advertising campaigns are still studied wherever it is that people study advertising in advertising school, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And he died and left the company to his daughter. She married Hutton, you know, the famous financier.
Right.
And they were going around buying up food companies. This was at a time when there were a lot of new ideas out about industrial food, you know, Jell-O and processed cheese and all sorts of things that we disdain today were, you know, the brilliant new inventions. And
where would we be without processed cheese? There would be nobody at the ballparks.
Well, you know, it's like I sometimes think that the true American cuisine is almost entirely based on melting cheese. You know. You know, you have macaroni and cheese and cheeseburgers and all these things,
yeah.
Cheese sauce. And,
was it always that way?
No, it wasn't until they did processed cheeses. There weren't all these melty cheese things.
Well, you know, we're down to our final break, and I do want to ask the big question to me, which is really this wonderful transition we've made from the food of yesteryear to industrial food, and now we seem to be glomming onto this idea of going back to some kind of local food. And I'd like to talk to you about that whole notion and how it fits into your scheme of things. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back with Mark Kurlansky. Well, folks, Clarence Birdseye and his contemporaries changed our lives by making the food that we eat convenient to eat. They did it many ways, but Clarence Birdseye probably was most famous for the making of frozen foods, real frozen foods that actually tasted almost fresh. A huge change from the way foods were frozen in the past, which is a very slow process in ice houses. Mechanical inventions changed that whole way of doing things. Mark Kurlansky, in writing Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man, what impact would this man have on our lives? How would you characterize that impact?
Well, the development of frozen food was really the underpinnings for the whole agro-industrial world, you know, for industrializing food and distributing it worldwide. You know, something that really hadn't happened before that. And Birdseye was very conscious of that. He thought it was very exciting.
And so he featured himself the revolutionary. How should we look back on this, we who live in the modern world, and take all of these things, these convenient foods for granted, these industrial foods that now come from factories far, far away? How should we look on this story?
Well, you know, there's a lot of fault with industrialized food. You have to look at it from the perspective of, I mean, people talk about being a locavore, you know, of eating just the fresh food from the neighborhood family farms. Well, Clarence Birdseye grew up in a world of locavores. Everybody was a locavore. In fact, in my book, Food of a Younger Land, which is about American food, it's American food writing from 1940, 1939, you see that America was still that world very much. What I noticed was that in the wintertime, people were eating a lot of canned food and salted food and
pickled, you know, foods.
Pickled food, things that, you know, sometimes were great and other times weren't. So if you lived in a world that was entirely locavore, you would actually, you know, sort of be yearning for some of these other things. It always makes me think about my father. My father's father was a tailor in Boston, and my father grew up with his father making all his clothes. So he had these handmade shirts and hand-tailored pants and hand-tailored suits. And he told me that when he was a child, his dream was to wear a factory-made suit.
And the same was true with food.
Right.
And so when we grow up and are forced to eat all of this home cooking, we look at this food in a fancy package and think, boy, I would love to taste that. And now that we live in a world where the home-cooked meal is the rarity, we look back at that time where...
Yeah, and there's something else also, that during the whole process of industrialization of food was also ran parallel with the process of emancipation of women. So... Yeah. You know, women were no longer at home cooking all day long. So there became a need for food that could be prepared quickly.
And thus the world we live in. Mark, we're out of time. Mark Kurlansky, Birdseye, The Adventures of a Curious Man. All kinds of fun stories Mark writes about food. Check them out. Thank you, Mark. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Always nice talking to you, Michael.
And thanks to you out there. Remember, stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.